On today's episode of Lucas Inside Track, I'm joined by Haitham Matar. Haitham is the CEO of IHG across Middle East, Africa, and southern parts of Asia. With over 35 years' experience and managing over 200 hotels with 24,000 employees, Haitham is the right guy to talk about when it comes to hospitality and tourism. I also knew Haitham a few years ago during our time together on Saudi Tourism. Haitham's challenges and insights are amazing. He's been through an incredible story, but the insights that he shares with me on today's show are about perseverance, about hard work, about determination, but also about the subtle art of serving others. And the importance of it, especially in 2025, has never been more profound. So join me on today's episode. It's going to be a cracker. Haitham, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
How are you feeling this Friday morning?
Feeling amazing. I just told you, I landed back from Mumbai late evening yesterday. I went straight to the gym. Did a bit of a spinning for about 40 minutes. Did sauna.
Got you.
Which really helped me to go straight to sleep. Woke up this morning crazy at 5, about 4:35 a.m. I was back in the gym. Beach walk for a bit of grounding. Had full breakfast, coffee, and I'm here with you again.
Look at that. Yeah. What a morning.
Almost like noon to me.
But I there's a part of me that's super envious of people like you who get up super early, get so much done before 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
There's a part of me that kind of hates you secretly as well. I hate those type of people. They're really happy morning people.
Listen, you know what I mean? Get on the list.
I tend to peak around sort of 2, 3 p.m. That's kind of when I tend to sort of wake up. Yeah. But obviously for you, you're a bit of a morning person.
I am. I'm a morning person. And I try to sustain energy through the food I eat, the exercises I do until 8 p.m. But I get really grumpy by 9. So don't try to call me or text me after 9 p.m.
It's a good thing we're shooting nice and early. We actually know each other. So we met during our time at Saudi Tourism Authority.
Amazing times, yes.
That was 4 years ago, give or take?
It was about four or five years ago.
Yeah.
Right. So it was interesting times. We were, together sort of right at the early stages of their tourism strategy and their media campaigns.
Crazy
and
times.
Obviously you and your team, the strategies you put on media planning and media buying. And it was amazing to be part of that journey right from the outset.
Yeah.
The learning that we got, I'm sure you did the same.
Yeah, I mean, look, the brief was nuts. I mean, it's basically for the first time ever, Saudi Arabia are opening for tourism.
Absolutely.
Right? So the brief that we got was we need to change the perception, the global perception of a country.
Yes.
Go. That's the brief.
And listen, that's hard work. Yeah, that's hard work. Yeah. And we both know, look, they put a lot of effort and threw a lot of money at it to change perceptions. Because I worked in Ras Al Khaimah. We'll talk about my bug, right? Yeah. My cub here. So my mug comes from His Highness, the ruler of Ras Al Khaimah. And I worked in Ras Al Khaimah, an emirate that didn't come with baggage. It was unknown, right? But I had to work on their tourism strategy, put it on the world map, built the longest zip line in the world. But then you go to Saudi, which has a lot of baggage.
A lot of negative PR.
Yeah, but also very well known globally, right? Yeah. Everybody knew what Saudi Arabia, and I was in the US in the 80s, Saudi Arabia, wow, okay, So, and it was known for oil and people just imagined it to be just a desert a city or a desert country. Little did we know, and you and I discovered when we got there, right? They got mountains and rivers and, amazing.
It's very impressive.
Biggest olive farm in the world and more. Yeah, amazing.
That's very impressive. Well, I love the fact that you brought up the mug first. I love that. I think you're the first guest that we've had that brings in the mug first. So the mug is from Ras Al Khaimah, right?
The mug is from Ras Al Khaimah. It's got the UAE emblem on it, as you can see. This was given to me by His Highness, the ruler, who I enjoyed working for, a visionary man in Ras Al Khaimah. He gave me the first opportunity to lead a tourism board. And then by de facto, UNWTO has declared me as minister level. So it was my first ministerial job ever in government, leaving corporate into that part of the world. And he's given me that total freedom. So he basically said, look, here's the framework, right? Here's the vision. You need to go out and do it. I want 3 million visitors in the next 10 years. I want to build more hotels. I want to attract FDI, foreign investments. And you got to go out and do it. So he gave me that free hand and I built a great team. We were about 130, 131 people in the tourism board in Ras Al Khaimah. And then trying to, get teams together and brainstorm. And how can we differentiate this little emirate, yet not try to tread toes, obviously, with Dubai or Abu Dhabi? We don't have the funds, we don't have the infrastructure, we don't have the global awareness. So we thought, look, you know what? outdoor and adventure. You've got the desert, you got the mountains, you got the sea, you got the beach.
It's naturally built for it.
Absolutely. So look, I went to Puerto Rico at the time with one of my colleagues, and it was my first time to ever jump off of a cliff on a zip line that was, you know, close to 3 kilometers long.
And at the time, that was the longest. They had the record. Right?
They did have the Guinness record for it. So the funny part is I met these, the owners of the park who developed, designed this, you know, they're called Toro Verde. Mm. They designed this park. So the great part is I told these guys over dinner, that, you know, thank you for hosting me, but I'm going to build the longest zipline in the world. And you sort of see the shock on their face going, no. And they said, the best thing they said is, well, you can't do it without us.
They want to help you.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, well, they want to keep the record.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah. I thought, amazing. So look, and they've been tried and tested. They've had zero incidents, zero accidents. They had ran it for 5 years. Right. So I thought, look, this is the partner I want to be with. And they came to Ras El Khaimah. We did a lot of, you know, looking around the mountains to really, you know, find the best spots, and ended up doing the longest zip line in the world and got a Guinness record for it.
It's amazing. Look, your story is incredible. You've got, what, 35 years, give or take, of tourism, hospitality experience?
Yeah, that's because I started at 5 years old, as you know. So, yeah 35 years.
By the way, you look incredibly good for your age.
Thank you, sir.
For those who are watching and not listening, have a guess about how old this man is.
Leave it alone. All right? Leave it alone.
Have a guess. Put it on the comments. Let me know. It will shock you. I tell you that. But you've had an amazing career. You've went private. You started off, I think it was in Crown Plaza. You started off at Marriott, even Marriott.
I started at a courtyard by Marriott, you know, which is their sort of mid-scale. And I was a dishwasher.
And that's the whole story.
That's the whole story. Yeah. So I talked to you about my book, Pots, Pans, and 5-Year Plans. It's my journey from dishwasher to CEO. And look, it's been a beautiful journey. And you have a lot of learnings of resilience, perseverance. And the book is a blueprint, Luca. It's a blueprint for those who aspire and dream big and want to be something one day.
Your story, I've done a lot of research on you, right? But I don't want to get into kind of the whole kind of autobiography kind of route, because I do want to talk to you about tourism and hospitality in today's
Amazing.
Age, right?
Amazing.
But what I will touch on is that I don't think there's someone who's better suited answering the questions about where tourism and hospitality is going in this part of the world than you. Because of your experience.
Thank you.
And I've seen firsthand just that the wealth of knowledge that you have is phenomenal. You know, they loved you so much, Intercontinental, they got you back.
Yeah, amazing.
You're now, what, managing hundreds of hotels,
yeah.
24,000 plus staff.
Absolutely.
$2 billion worth in terms of investments and revenue. So it's a huge amount of portfolio sort of sits under you. Not just the Middle East and Africa, but also southern parts of Asia.
Correct. Southeast Asia. So Seychelles, Mauritius, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Nepal, India. Yeah.
So Haitham, you're obviously Lebanese, but you left Lebanon at a very young age, right?
Five years old.
During the Civil War, and you went to the US.
Correct.
And then you came back to the region. You were a young teenager, right?
Actually, not teenager. I was in my 20s. So I was 25 years old.
You're 25.
I was 25. And then I went back to the US, came back again at the age of 30.
Yeah.
I came in with Intercontinental. I worked at the first Intercontinental here built in Dubai in 1975. It's the Intercon that was on the creek. And I came in to run the front office and rooms division, if you like. And then I became director of sales and marketing in that hotel. 5 years later, I got to corporate, from one hotel to 90 Middle East Africa back then. And I was in commercial. I was leading commercial.
But the whole story started, and the whole book that you've written was about you starting off as a dishwasher.
Absolutely.
You were 17?
I was 17 when I started.
And you were in the U.S.?
I was in the U.S.
And that was at the Marriott?
That was at the Courtyard by Marriott on Delk Road in Marietta, Georgia, in Atlanta.
When you wash plates at home, do you ever look back and start, do you ever have a little chuckle to yourself and go, you know what, however many years ago, I don't want to give away your age, but do you ever look back and go, you know what, look how far I've come?
Yes.
And do you have that level? I mean, I don't know how you feel about it, but when I wash dishes sometimes now, fortunate enough in Dubai, we have help, right?
Yeah.
But every now and again, when you wash dishes, it kind of grounds you. Do you feel like it helps ground you as well?
Getting
back to basics?
Look, I'm also fortunate where I live. My house has a beautiful window just off the kitchen sink into my front yard. So I have and I get a lot of birds coming to eat the food that I put out for them and the water I put out for them. So I've got this beautiful view of these green parrots that you see out there and the beautiful birds. And some of my neighbors brought these peacocks who come over also for food. So I'm fortunate where I live, and that window to the outdoors with me washing dishes is helps me with my reflections. And also, it's very, to me, it's very therapeutic, right? So I was a dishwasher. You know, I was, you know, became a CEO. I'm a managing director of one of the, you know, third largest hotel companies in the world, and I'm still a dishwasher in on the inside, right? Mm-hmm. It's about me being of service to others.
Yeah.
You know, I've traded my apron and you know, dirty shoes and
for a nice suit.
So I've left the dish room to the boardroom. But it's I'm still the same guy.
Do you ever get that imposter syndrome that a lot of people get, where they're like, you look around and go, I can't believe I'm actually here. I can't believe how I actually started.
No, because I grew through the ranks with very solid strides, and I've fallen a number of times, and I've gotten right back up, and I've failed a number of times and gotten right back up, and I've learned from my failures.
What's your biggest failure that you've had so far?
So look, one of my biggest failures is when I let my ego take over. And we're all human beings, right? And my ego took over so much that it impacted me afterwards. So the fall from my ego made my saboteur, yeah, your saboteur, your gremlin on the left now, take over. So all the noises in my head were about, you're not so good. You know, you don't know that much. You're a freaking dishwasher. You know, what are you talking about? You know, because you're here now, you're suddenly smarter and better than everybody. So I had to go seek an executive coach. I spent 6 months with an executive coach who helped me create the balance. And I actually read a book called Taming Your Gremlin. And that book was insightful for me. And it gave me a lot of learnings on how to tame my saboteur and to manage my ego. And as we grow older, we realize that some of our reactions, not responses, because when you're a leader, you respond, you don't react. Yeah. Some of our reactions are actually are a response of your ego. Your ego is telling you, do this, right? And as you get older, you take time when you receive that message that just makes your blood start to boil and your temperature to rise, right? And you take your time and you reflect. And sometimes because you become wiser and because you've made so many mistakes and you've learned from them now, you decide, you know what, maybe I'm going to respond later, or maybe I'm actually not going to respond at all, right? So, and then that's okay too. And no answer is an answer.
No good decision is ever done well when you're immediately reacting to something.
Absolutely.
Especially if it's emotional. What's it like for you being that leader? Does it feel comfortable with you? And if so, what do you think makes a good leader in 2025?
Look, what makes a good leader is a leader who is self-aware and continues to seek learning. You know, I was just at this leadership course. It's called Leading for Growth by Cambridge in North Carolina, and we sat around in a circle with other leaders and senior leaders from my company. We were checking in. The first thing that came of my mouth, I said, "I'm here to learn," right? And the coach was a bit shocked, you know, thinking, "Kids." Technically, I was the most senior person in that room, and I'm already giving the message to everybody. I am here to learn, right? That put the fences down.
It's disarming. It disarmed. It disarmed everybody.
Absolutely. And one of the ladies who was, you know, we were working on groups. She was with me on one of the groups. She said, you know, when you walked in, you have that sort of intimidation to you. It's just that
really?
Aura. That's yeah. what she told me. She okay. said, you know, you're a bit intimidated. I get told a lot, by the way, that when I walk into a room, without saying anything, I sort of intimidate people. And that's a big onus on me, because it's that when I hear this, it makes me want to work harder to disarm
them.
Yeah. And she said, as soon as you opened your mouth, we thought, oh, wow. Because she said, you know, quote unquote, in her mind, oh man, he's senior as shit. He's like really senior, this guy, right? And then she thought, but he's approachable. I can talk to him. So she felt really comfortable, you know, talking to me. But yeah, you know, a leader today has to have humility. And I think one of the, you know, hardest parts today, we talk about tourism and travel, trying to attract the young generation, Z and Alpha for the future. If we don't change our culture of being, you know, because I'm older and I got a bit more gray hair, I'm wiser and I know more than you, and no, I don't want to listen to you. I listen to my own kids. I listen to their advice. I seek their advice. They see the world in a different lens.
Yeah.
And it can't be lesser than what I've seen it, and mine can't be better. And not because, you know, I've made mistakes. I don't want them to make those mistakes. No, let them make those mistakes and let me watch how they come out of it.
Yeah,
might be different.
I do want to talk about the talent issues. It is a big talent issue. I want to talk about the book as well. Before I go any further, usually I ask my guests for a safe word. So if there's a question that you don't want to answer, do you have a safe word in mind?
Banana.
I think you're the third person to say banana.
But is that right?
But at least you didn't say pineapple, which is amazing. I've had like so many different types of fruit. I've had watermelon, I've had pineapple, I've had bananas.
Yeah, we have bananas. Easy, just banana.
Done. Are you the kind of person that avoids tough questions?
No, I don't. But
some CEOs don't like to go down that route.
I don't mind, as long as the question and my answer is not offending anybody in any way, or is not misconstrued by any way, or is not perceived as I'm trying to position anything. Yeah. I make sure I answer those questions. Yeah.
So the book Pots, Pans, and 5-Year Plans. Mm-hmm. So what I took most from it, and I went through most of the chapters.
Well, thank you for taking
the time. We only spoke about it last week. But yes. The story really is about, in my opinion, it's about your love of service, the mm-hmm. service industry, mm-hmm. and the determination and grit that you need to be successful in this day and age.
Absolutely.
With a big message to the younger generation, guys, come on.
Yeah.
Right? In a roundabout way, when you feel like there is no longer the same level of interest there once was for people to come in and serve other people.
Absolutely.
And the industry needs to almost redefine itself or change how it kind of attract and retain young talent in order for it to continue to be successful.
100%. And look, you watch Rocky movies, all of them, right? And you know the song, There's No Easy Way Out. I grew up in a big family. We're 9 brothers and sisters. And I'm the youngest boy. And you get a lot of criticism, right, from top down all the time. So everybody's criticizing.
I can relate. I'm the youngest as well.
There you go. So whatever
not
you do.
Not 9, though.
How you
just
say,
a 4.
Yeah. But look, that shaped me as a person, as a human being. It shaped me, made me who I am today, right? And I'm grateful for all that criticism. I'm grateful for the criticism that was given to me. Although I didn't like it when I was little, but as you grow older, you appreciate and you understand why that was given to you, because it shapes you as a person. And it gave me that resilience. Yeah, as I grew older, that resilience sort of, you know, got stronger and stronger with me. And I started to persevere, because I can see my oldest brothers and sisters, you know, thriving in life, doing great things. And I started to persevere more. I want to do more. And I had always proved myself. Yeah, I'm going to do better. I'm going to do more.
Competitive,
yeah. And my mother sort of instilled that in all of us, including me, the youngest, you know. And she was always telling me, look, you must have, you know, reasonable professional jealousy, even in school. Like, look at the top of the class, see what they're doing. Be jealous of what they're doing. Not envious, right? Not envious, but be jealous so you can do better. And that was just something that always resonated with me, even at work. So I always look at my peers, I look at my seniors and see, what are they doing differently than I'm doing? How do they handle situations? How do they speak? How do they show up? So important how you show up, right? Because when you become at a level of ours in a business, people look at you for every single thing. You're being watched 24/7.
What you say, what you wear, how you say
what you eat, how you dress,
what time you show up, how you show
100%.
Up.
100%. Because look,
the car you drive.
And it's not because they're trying to criticize you, but everybody looks for a role model.
You're the benchmark.
You're the benchmark.
You're the future benchmark that they're aspiring to.
Exactly, yeah. So if I want to be that role, do I need to dress up like that? Do I need to show up like that? Do I need to say things like that? So you become a role model. So if you want to be exemplary, you must be self-conscious. You have to be very careful about how you're showing up to others. Behaviors. It's behaviors. Do you know when people say, you know, this guy got fired, but why? I mean, the guy's numbers, he's the production, the productivity he produced. You could be a high performing individual, but you could be a low potential simply because of your behaviors. And one of my failures when I became a waiter at one of the top restaurants in Atlanta, Georgia, it was actually the highest or the tallest hotel in the world back then. It was the Westin Peachtree Plaza, still exists. And I was on the 73rd floor, or 72nd floor, 73rd was a bar. It was a revolving restaurant, right?
One of those,
yeah.
That always freaked me out, though.
I lost about 3 kilos in the first week, because you're just running around. So imagine this, Luca. So you got a kitchen that's square and still, and you got a circular restaurant that revolves, right? So you have 4 entrances to this kitchen. And the kitchen's got the cold section, the bread section, the bar, and the hot food.
So the kitchen never moves.
Never moves. Right?
Everything else moves.
So depending where you are when you're taking your order and it's moving, you've got to take the right door to pick up the bread, the salad, right? So I was doing that, but I was exiting from the wrong door. So when I exit, you get, where's my table? So I got to run around the whole restaurant trying to find until, you know, one of the...
Wouldn't you get seasick if you're like the chef in that restaurant and you're just seeing the entire outdoor world sort of spinning around you? Wouldn't that make you feel...
No, they don't move that fast. They don't move that fast. They're quite you know, subtle how they move. But if you're spending a lot of time inside a still kitchen, that movement is there. And if you come back the same door you entered, you're going to miss them, obviously, right? I had an Italian waiter named Mario who said, hey, come here. If you're going to keep running like this, you got to be like that. So just think, you came in this door, they moved, you go out that door. Light bulbs. So
So do you feel people in this day and age, 2025, are working as hard as you did back then?
Yes. I work with colleagues in my company who are in their 30s. And they work really hard, and they hustle, right?
Is that still the key to success? Do you still need to work harder than anyone else to be successful?
I don't think you need to work just hard. I think it's a combination of being smart and hard.
Because that was our entry level, right? We were always told as kids, you got to work hard to be successful.
Look, I'll give you an example. I take my team, whether they're in commercial or whether in development, right? Let's say you're in development. And in development, you are growing the company's portfolio. You're signing new hotels, new deals, we call them, right? And you are in a very competitive market. So it's me, IHG, against Marriott or Hilton or Accor, whichever company. We're all going in there in a very healthy, competitive environment because the owner or the investor has this array of brands to choose from, right? And he's the king. And you've got to come in and do your pitch. So the team... If they don't do enough homework, research, analysis, projections, and go there showing up at their best, they're not going to get that deal. And that deal impacts their income, impacts their growth, you know, personal growth, financial growth. And if they don't work really, really hard and be there first to submit their projections and their pitch, somebody else will do it first. And in a market like Saudi Arabia or the UAE, you have people who want to work at very, very, very high speed, and it could be late hours. I've had team members go to Saudi in Ramadan to attend meetings at 11 p.m. that finish at 3 a.m. But you know what? That's what the job calls for. That's hard work, Luca. Yeah. So depending on what industry, I mean, do you think people who work in the financial market don't work hard? Of course they do.
If you're a 21-year-old, you're coming out of university right now. Do you think you want a career that's going to be determined by how hard you work?
Look,
or how fast you can make money?
No, it's going to be how fast you make money. And I judge this from my own son. He's 22. And obviously, look, he's looking, I've given him an opportunity to work at the Willard Intercontinental in Washington, D.C., and as a part-time job, right? And he's like a stone throw from the White House, for Christ's sake, right? I mean, what else can you get in terms of address to start your sort of internship with? And he's not in hospitality. He doesn't want to do hospitality. He's into artificial intelligence engineering and data analysis, which is, you know, great for him. But he did a couple of days at reception and he said, why would I stand on my feet for 8 hours a day waiting on people to check in and check out? So you see, I could have been somewhere trading money, making stuff this quick, right?
So what's your take right now on the current state of hospitality? I know it's a very broad question, but what's the first thing that comes to your mind? I mean, I've got a bunch of questions in there. We're going to go into detail. But from a macro perspective, what's your take on hospitality right now?
Hospitality remains to be a traditional business in everything that we do. Right? We are the core purpose. This is the business of people. And the core purpose of hospitality is as it says, to be hospitable and to be of service to guests, to employees, to team members, to owners, right? And to shareholders and stakeholders. And that requires passion. Today, I don't believe there's enough people that are graduating from school with that passion, because the hospitality industry it sucks you into it, and if you love it, you're just in it. Why is that, Luca? You could be in your 20s where you want to enjoy life, you want to enjoy your weekends, and you want to go on holidays, and you want to go to the Big Apple for New Year's Eve, and you want to enjoy Christmas.
You can't do that
because that's the busiest times of the year. And that's where you need to be of service to others. Yeah. Do you know what? Until the age of probably
It's a lot of sacrifice.
30? I mean, I'd say until I was 30, I had to work through all these holidays. Mm. I couldn't be home with family or friends.
But it's a huge sacrifice.
It's a huge sacrifice. But again, you would do that sacrifice if you had the passion and if you knew that whatever you're doing is rewarding. As long as you're seeing the reward, you know, what kept me in the hospitality industry is the reward. And it's not just rewards of financial. Look, hospitality doesn't pay a lot of money, so you know. It's not the financial reward. It's that
yeah. For those who are interested right now.
Just in case, yeah. You got to do it, yeah. And I'm not saying do it for passion, but look, you make money, but you're not into, you know, IT or whatever, you know, you're not, you know. And if how much money do you want to make? You know, if you want to just enjoy life, you'll have enough money to enjoy. I mean, nobody ever took money to the grave. And you know, interesting. I met a person recently who told me something that sort of really resonated with me. His father was a bit hard on them, and when his father died, he left 120 exclusive single malt whiskey bottles for them that were probably 50 to 100 years old, right? He left these for them as to call it an inheritance. So the father must have just, you know, just
amassed bottles of the whiskey bottles.
Absolutely, but he left them a whole cask of whiskey in the UK.
Yeah. It must be worth thousands.
Thousands, yeah. All right. So what did they do when the father died? They invited friends and they drank all 120 bottles over a week, or 3 days, or whatever. Right? Astonishing. The father might as well just sold these bottles before he died and did something with it, right? And enjoyed his life, right? So look, it's I saw a guy with a T-shirt the other day. It says, you know, fly first class or your children will, right? I'm not saying, you know, leave your children stranded, but you've got to make sure that whatever job you're getting, you love and you have passion and you enjoy it, and money comes, money goes. And it's about priorities. I have people who worked with me and were driving super fancy cars. I drove fancy cars in the past until my interest now shifted from fancy cars to real estate. I just want to buy real estate. That's how your passion shifts. You know, you want appreciating assets, not depreciating assets. So, you know, I drove them all. I had them all. And now I'm not that interested anymore. So yes, in hospitality, yeah, you can drive nice cars and you can do whatever you want. But it's, what do you want to do? Do you just want to, you know, stack money and have money? If you had $1 million today, Luca, and or you had $5 million today, how would your lifestyle change? Or maybe change that differently. If you had $100 million and you had $200 million, how would your lifestyle change?
It would change.
To what extent?
It wouldn't be as big as, it wouldn't be a, no, between the differences between both, no, it's okay. Minimal.
So if you want to have 100 million and you're satisfied, or you're going to be just keep running after it to get it to 200, because then your ego and your greed.
There's never enough money. So if it's not about money, right, what is your pitch to the 21-year-old coming out of university to get into this industry? Because you've said on many different podcasts as well that your biggest challenge is attracting and retaining the best talent.
Yeah.
So what is your sales pitch then?
Look, the first, hospitality is so diverse. Hospitality, most young people imagine that you're dishwashing, you're serving, you're a waiter. It's so diverse. We've got people who work in IT, you got people in finance, you got marketing, which is an extremely rewarding job in marketing, because marketing today has you know, morphed into so many things: social media, media buying, media planning. Yeah. So marketing is not what just one function; it's multiple functions into marketing. Sales has morphed into, you know, a whole different world. Revenue management has now generative AI, and you're now working with tools, and you know, IT is you know, and technology has become embedded into revenue management. And then you have, you know, finance. So people go to school; they want to work in finance, and go to a finance company. Well, you can be in hospitality, work for finance, and you can be an engineer. You know, you could be.
You've got many opportunities within that.
Many options.
But let me pitch in a different way. If you're a 21-year-old and you say, you know what, I want to go work for an airline, because an airline, I get to see the world. I've been in my home country my whole life. An airline will give me a chance to see the world. Right. That's a very clear USP with that type of industry. What is it for? Because I want to get. I'm hoping we're going to go into the same direction. What is it if you work at a hotel? What is it that you get that's unique at a hotel that you will never find anywhere else?
Two things. One, by the way, working in a hotel also gets you to see the world, because when you, you travel to stay at hotels around the world where you get employee rates and you get free rooms or what have you, right? So you do travel. Yeah. I spend at least 70% of my work life on travel. Right. I travel a lot. I've seen the world through hospitality. Mm-hmm. So you do travel. Mm-hmm. And the ambition is not that you're just working in a hotel. Your ambition is to grow into that corporate world of hospitality and travel the world, right? Conferences and events. And these are so rewarding. And then you meet so many people from all walks of earth.
And that's the second thing.
That's the thing.
And that's what I was coming towards.
Absolutely. You know, meeting people and just, I've met people through my work in hotels. I've met an older gentleman in the year 2000 when I worked at the hotel at the Instagram, who kept in touch with me and wrote me emails and told me about all his trips and where he went. And then he told me how he lost his wife.
So nice. Okay. I was going to say that was so nice until that point.
Yeah. Well, look, look, it's all nice because it's part of life. Yeah. He lost his wife and then he was on his own and he was still traveling and he was going to places he went with her, you know, and he just made effort to stay in touch with me, and I'm 30 years younger than him, right? Yeah. And he just really, all wanted to do is
connections
share.
That you make, connections, the emotional connections that you make.
Yeah. And you also, look, you make connections on a personal front. I've met friends through the hospitality that are still friends. And you make professional connections as well. And you learn so much about people. People come through these hotels, they come through the doors and they stay and everybody's got a story.
Exactly. And I've read that in the book, and you're like, your job is to make them feel as comfortable as they can.
Absolutely.
When they go to bed.
And safe.
And safe when they go to bed. How many people do you reckon have come in and out of your hotels over your 35 years?
Oh my goodness, millions.
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 It's not nuts when you think about it. How many, indirectly, it would have happened to me.
Right? Yeah.
I would have stayed in one of the hotels that you've operated in or worked in. So I would have been one of those people.
Yeah.
What is it that you want people to leave when they leave a hotel? What is it, that one feeling that you want them to have?
Look, you always want guests to come to hotels and have memorable experiences that they go home and tell their friends and family about, right? That's the part. So in a hotel, you've got what we call the customer journey. And as you know from your marketing days, you'd remember the customer touch points, as we call them, right? And throughout the journey, whether when they're checking in, or they're going in the elevator, or they're going to the club lounge, or going to the restaurant, or they're in their room, how do you make sure that every touch point offers some sort of experience that wows them? They go, wow. And especially not just your repeat guest, but your new guest who've just come in and you've made effort to learn about them a little bit and their preferences, right? And you suddenly surprise them. I stay at my hotels now across my region, and I often get surprised. I handed you today these drip bags of coffee. It's amazing how hotel teams watch every behavior of their guest. They watch my behaviors in the room. They've seen me use these drip coffees, and they go out, make effort. They buy these coffee drips bags, and they start to compete who's going to give me the best coffee drip.
Right? Well, because they're just kissing ass, let's be honest.
No. Luca, they love, look, the culture of a hotelier is they always want to impress.
Love that.
They just want to impress.
Do you think everyone has that? Because I'll tell you that, I think they don't. Like, a lot of people take the job, they fall into the industry because it's like, okay, let's try it. Look, and they don't have that genuine passion or interest in trying to take care of others.
I can't generalize. We're all different people, right? I tell you, I speak to about myself and most people that I've worked with who are really passionate. The key is passion. You got to be passionate about the hospitality industry, right? And if you are that passionate and you love serving on others, I tell you, for example, how much I love serving others, right?
I can see that.
You talked earlier about having help at home. I got help at home. So I like to cook. My helper likes to help me cook. And I just don't necessarily want her to help me because I enjoy that. But I don't want to tell her no because she enjoys helping me too. So I allow,
mutually allowing each other to sort of.
Yes. Yeah. So I say, you do this and I'll do that. Now, she leaves me to eat and she says, please call me to come and wash the dishes. 9 out of 10 times, Luca, I beat her to it. She comes. And she finds me what I've done.
She's the luckiest helper.
I tell you,
Dubai.
I'm done with the dishes. And she comes in and says, Mister, why not call me?
So you remember you talked about the user journey, right? And the different touch points.
Yes.
So I would argue that the most important touch point of that journey is at the front desk.
100%.
The second you
first
walk,
impression.
Yeah, the first impression. Most people have come to a hotel if it's a leisure trip, they've traveled a long way to be there, right? It could be a 9-hour flight. It could have had a nightmare transit, what the case is. They're exhausted. They're tired. That welcome is everything, because for them, it's like, okay, they finally reached the hotel. They've had a nightmare journey getting there. It's the refuge. That welcome, if it goes badly, no matter how good you are as a hotel in general, and all the other touch points are amazing, that first impression, it's very difficult to recover from that.
You're absolutely right. And you said earlier, you know, you asked me earlier, what do you think is challenging the hospitality industry today, right? Here's a bit of an analogy. I call this the travel anxiety. We all have it. We sometimes are aware of it and sometimes we're not. It starts from the moment you pack your bag, right? You're thinking, you know, is my bag going to go through the scanner? Are they going to pull me to the side because I have too many cables or because of a charge bank or have this? That's anxiety. You're already worried about that. If you're going on holidays, you start to think, is my bag going to be okay? Or is it going to be overweight? Am I going to be embarrassed in the middle of the airport opening my bag and taking stuff out because you have to reduce weight? And it happened to all of us, right? And you go through that anxiety. You go through anxiety, even though you're 100% sure your passport and everything is okay. As soon as you hand it over to immigration, your heartbeat starts to rise for some reason, right? You're clear. It's that fear because the immigration officer is serious and he takes your passport and you just don't know until you hear that stamp noise, that sense of relief. And then they release the door for you and off you go. But that travel anxiety starts from the moment you plan your trip, even when you start booking, right? Rates, availability, what have you. Now, many airports like Dubai, where we are very blessed, you have this, you know, you walk straight through the, you know, face.
No stamps.
No stamps. And you can, you know, get straight through these doors and very easy. And they have removed, you know, started to reduce that travel anxiety on you. Where the disconnect is, Luca, is you arrive, as you already said, you arrive at the hotel, you've done an 8-hour flight, 3-hour flight, 4-hour flight, and you've gone through that whole anxiety, the whole travel anxiety, and then you got to wait in a queue. And now the anxiety starts again because you're waiting in a queue and your subconscious mind starts to ask you this, and do they have your room ready? Do you get the right view? Do you have the right size, you know, bed size? Or
absolutely,
am I next to the elevator? Because you're going through this, right? By the time you get to the reception, and if one small thing goes wrong, and it could be tiny and irrelevant in the scheme of things, but because of this buildup of anxiety you've had, and then I made you wait in a queue, you're going to blow up. And that is where the hospitality industry still is working to solve for. Even when you go to a luxury hotel today, some, not all, still make you queue. And you think, why am I queuing? I've sent you my passport details. I've sent you my credit card. I booked a room. I even paid in advance. Just give me a key and let me go. Yeah.
So that happened to me. I was in Lebanon 3 days ago.
Ah, don't name the hotel.
Yeah, I went. I won't. It was a guest house. Beautiful. Up in the mountains. And I arrived. They took my bag and said, this is your room. We'll do all the paperwork later.
Amazing.
See? And that's how it should be.
And if a small guest house like this can do it,
yeah,
why can't we do it?
Yeah. Right, we're going to get into the meat of the show.
Amazing.
Right?
I thought ready? We did it.
Yeah, no, this is the warm-up. I'm warming you up. So you're going to take charge. There are 8 golf balls in this bag. There's a question on each golf ball. Read them out loud one by one and let's have a chat.
All right, let's start. Let's have a look.
Hi, everyone. I really hope you're enjoying the episode so far. Thank you so much for watching and listening. Throughout my career, I've met a lot of people that have anxiety when it comes to public speaking. If you're someone that has that anxiety or nervousness and has always wanted to be more confident in public speaking, but you're also not sure where to go or how to start, the good news is I might be able to help. I have 20 years experience working in corporate communication. I'm a former regional CEO and I've helped to win over 80 different clients through new business pitches. With so many online trainings based on theory, I wanted to share what's helped me in the business world. I've launched my own training program called Master Pitch. The 7-module course covers everything you need to know, whether it's learning how to really understand the audience, how to deliver real impact, or how to effectively storytell, I've got it covered. With practical tips and real examples, you can immediately start turning that anxiety into confidence. Also, in a world of AI, there's never been a more important time to invest in your personal brand and in developing your public speaking. For more information, go to lucaalam.com or drop me an email at info@lucaalam.com. Right, let's get back to the episode.
Saudi Arabia, the toughest tourism challenge of modern times?
Question mark.
Yes. Yes, it's, you know, remember we started the call of the last frontier.
So you get the call, right? At the time you were working in Ras Al Khaimah, right? You get the call to say, hey, we want you to come and help us launch Saudi tourism to the world.
Yes.
Mas o menos, more or less, right? How's that feeling? And you're like, wow.
Scared. And started to think broader. So I'm in Ras Al Khaimah with about 1,000 people population, Bethlehem, close to 1 million visitors. And I go to a country with 34 million people. And they're talking about 100 million plus visits by. And Yadok and Saudi's got what? 12, 13 regions. And it's so diverse. And it, you know, cities that border with Yemen, I'm completely different than those that border with Jordan. And it just made me really, really think. And then you start to get uncold. Yeah. You think, there are a lot of noises, a lot, you know, sort of, if you look at the geopolitical stuff and if you look.
What was your perception before you went to Saudi, of Saudi?
So look, fortunately, I had been traveling to Saudi in my business, in my career, and when I was with IHG before, Saudi was the biggest market to the UAE, and we would travel on sales calls when we say, so we'd visit government entities, we'd cover, you know, travel agents, stores. So I knew the country. And my perception, my experience was, as soon as I was the man in a suit, yeah, I was already differentiated. So I was on the sideline. Doesn't matter. I'm Muslim, but it doesn't matter. And when you went to a restaurant, there was this separation. So, you know, you had these caravans, these old caravans and restaurants. So families go here, you know.
Yeah.
You know, but you're single. It's like, oh, sing it.
Yeah.
That corner.
The back.
Yeah, blackout. That, yeah. You don't talk to anybody. No. You don't even go to the.
But this was 15, 20 years ago. What are we talking?
50 years. Yeah. And look, and then, you know, the rigidity, you know, I was in Saudi where I was walking in a mall. And then I basically whacked with a stick by one of the towers because I wasn't going to prayer. So I had to run, you know, find a place to pray. And look, it's refreshing to see what His Royal Highness Mohammed bin Salman has done to open the country, to liberate, give them freedom. Yet what I love about the Saudis is they've retained their culture. Mm. Yeah, so they've opened up, but they've retained it.
Yeah, they love hosting. That's why I noticed most about them. And that's something that's been common throughout. But the challenge, the brief, was enormous. You're basically trying to convince people to go to Saudi Arabia versus any other country around this region or south parts of Asia with zero legacy tourism and also a lot of negative PR in all the Western media. I mean, it doesn't get harder than that.
As complicated as it looked and sounded by fan, I think what gave in was their natural assets, was their culture, was their history. Because they, what you mentioned, their hospitality. And listen, tourism is not new to Saudi. Tourism dates back to 1500 years.
Yeah, religious tourism.
Religious tourism. So they know how to host people, you know, said, right? And you know, they've got amazing stories in them. Date back to the 7th century about, you know, this Hatem Tai, who was a poet in the 7th century. He was known for his extreme generosity. And he comes from a village called Hai. And until today, by the way, if you go to Hai, the people of Hai don't have a front door. Or if they do, the door is open. So any man, any woman can walk in. You know, they'll serve you dates, coffee, and no questions asked. No questions asked. And it's just that generosity that they kept on us. And the Saudis are generous. And I think that, you know, hospitality needs generosity. And I think with the generosity, their hospitality, their culture, their heritage, their history, and opening all that up to the world. To, you know, remember, they said open hearts, open doors to the world. And I think that the messaging was powerful.
Yeah.
It allowed people to want to come to Saudi. Even if it was for the novelty. Imagine this is a country that was closed for over 100 years. And now it's open. People just want to do
it's massive curiosity. Yeah, it's curiosity.
It's curiosity. Yeah, what is this about? And the trick is for Saudi is to get that repeat business. So have you killed the trip of curiosity? I've come and seen it.
Yeah, and not business tourism and not religious tourism, but actual leisure tourism. Yeah. And they're doing it. Look, they're investing so much money in events this and that. And the World Cup's obviously going to come as well to Saudi.
And then I say, look, hats off to where they got today from when we first got in and saw how complicated. The Saudi themselves, I worked with, were in doubt. They were asking seriously. People are actually going to come here for tourism? This is a that grew up through
yeah
for tourism.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, they, going out to watch movies, yeah. travel to another country just to go to the theater. Imagine, right? So
yeah, it's crazy.
Amazing. Yeah, but yeah.
So massive challenge. Good. Next ball, my friend. We're on a roll.
Grow sustainably or sustainability will enable growth.
Grow sustainably as a business or sustainability. If you focus on sustainability, that's what's actually going to get you growth. Or can it actually get you growth if you focus on sustainability? You can't go both. This show is about pick a side.
Well, let me tell you. So in my mind, both, but yeah, and this second, I would say though, sustainability would enable growth. It's the
easy to say.
Yeah, it's the horse or the carriage. Yeah, which one goes first, right? If you say, I want to grow sustainably, or if I start with sustainability, it's going to help me grow. So if your objective is growth, you're going to lose the eye on the ball, and you got to think about growth. If you just focus on sustainability, things will come. And I'll tell you why. A recent study that Intercontinental has done showed that 80% of the respondents say they would pay 31% more on average to stay in a hotel that executes sustainable practices. So your job today is not to focus on growing sustainably all day, but to execute on the sustainability actions. It's not just about, you know, the glass, you know, get rid of plastic bottles and moving that to glass or that. It's well beyond that. And make, look, I got to say, sustainability, a lot of people misunderstand it. You know, I was fortunate to be part of the steering committee that worked on the 17 sustainable goals that you and the WTO launched in 2017. So I understand sustainability.
But they were big goals. And as you said back then, they were very unrealistic. Absolutely. And so, I mean, where are we on the 17 goals?
No, so I've seen nations actually adapt four, maybe three of those goals, but I've never seen anyone.
Yeah, it's tough.
Dude, it's tough. It's tough.
You know, and expensive.
In some, it's expensive. It's expensive. It is.
And that's the problem.
Now, it's an investment. So let's take that, narrow that down to about health. All right. And if we tell an owner today who is new build versus a conversion, very different because the cost is different, right? So a new build, you said, design your own self to be sustainable in every aspect, right? Yeah, whether it's your air conditioning, whether it's your smart room manager system, whether it's your LED lights, whatever. So when you design from the outset and build for it, it's going to cost you a little bit more, but you're building an asset that will
appreciate
in fact when you try to sell it in the future because it's already got the sustainable certificates. Well, right? And sustainability, again, is not about green tourism. It's not, you know, it's so many things. Look at food waste. I mean, I'm not a fan of buffets. Yeah, and I'm not a fan only because I see the amount of food that gets thrown.
But that's, by the way, that's food waste at the end. That's wastage. But there's in the food production, if the potato doesn't look good, they throw it. If the logistics of transporting that potato halfway around the world, it doesn't last the refrigerator, whatever the case is, they throw it. So food waste isn't just what gets thrown at the end. It's the entire supply chain of it.
But yeah, look, countries like the UAE have been doing an amazing job in growing produce locally. And our hotels are seeking local produce procurement.
But it is tough. But you would much more say growth will come if you invest in sustainability.
Growth will come if you invest in sustainability.
Love it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Love it.
So, next question.
You don't have to keep that. You're going to keep the balls in your hand. I love it. You're doing an Alan Bergeni on me.
Yeah.
All right.
So, rank in importance to a guest. Price, rating, location, amenities, and loyalty. So, that's a very good question. A lot of people are points junkies. They love their rewards. And our loyal members, repeat members, in some hotels, we have up to 50% loyal members, repeat. They come because of the ISG rewards. Now, I'm a points junkie as well. I'm sure you are too. You know, I love my coins. I love redeeming those points, especially with the Emirates Airlines or whatever. And loyalty stems from the experience you get and the sense of belonging in that brand. It's that brand affinity, right? When you start to develop that brand affinity and everybody wants to go where everybody knows their name. So that starts to build loyalty. And you know, there's no more status than you walking through the doors. Welcome back, Mr. Luca, king of the world. And you know what? You're the king of the world even more when other people in the lobby have heard that.
Yeah.
You want regular, right?
Especially with Emirates when they go around the plane. And they're like,
how rewarding is that? Yeah, I mean, basically be like the king of the world. And the guy next to you is like, he must be portly. Loyalty drives price. When you're a loyal member, you come repeat. You get special rates, special upgrades. So drives price.
But how many people are actual members of hotels?
Oh.
as a percentage of guests who come?
We have over 100 million.
Give me a percentage.
In hotels, you have up to 40% of loyal IHG reward members that stay in the hotels, right? It's an average. Some of that's a 10%, right?
Yeah.
So we have up in more than 40. Today we have 46% what we call loyalty contribution, right? What's contributing to our business is the loyal members who are
okay.
Money and
so loyalty comes first for you. For a guest, what comes second?
Because loyalty drives everything else.
Okay.
Right? With loyalty, you get great rates. And you.
So price will come second.
Price will come second because loyalty.
Okay.
Location. Location comes almost second or third.
Okay.
Because you know, you want to go to a hotel that you are centrally located, you know, within walking distance if you're in a city or close to where you want. Rating, but once you become. I look at rating if I'm going somewhere I don't know. If it's a brand I trust, for example, not because I work for IHG, but one of our brands, the Intercontinental, is so consistent that it doesn't matter where in the world you go, you know what you're going to get.
Yeah.
It's a traditional luxury brand.
Yeah.
So, and look, with loyalty, guess what? Because you're a regular, they know what you like, they know your preferences, and you get amazing amenities. So hence I went straight to loyalty because loyalty drives everything else.
Okay. So in order, it would be loyalty, price, location, amenities. Okay.
Dashboard. So tech integration, digitization or human interaction and soulful service.
So you went to a hotel in Berlin that was all digital, right? And you hated it. But you didn't like it because it didn't have that personal human touch. But at the same time, you recognize that more and more hotels are going down the tech route, the digitization route. So if you had to choose, right, as you, as either the CEO of IHG in this region, or as a guest, would you prefer the digitization and the sort of tech experience, or would you go with the human touch and the soulful kind of experience?
So look, I'll give you a quick answer, but first I'll give you a long answer. So in hospitality, there's high touch and high tech. I prefer high touch. I love technology. But I want to deal with people. In certain parts, you must have seen this in my book. There's certain parts of the journey I don't necessarily need to interact with people. Example, let's say I'm gonna order laundry. I don't want to call somebody.
No.
You send somebody to the laundry.
Especially if they're in China.
Especially in China, yeah. Laundry open, laundry not open. So I just want to have a...
Read the book.
Yeah, I'd read the book. I just want to have that allows me to go click, 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 leave my laundry bag outside, somebody picks it up, and then I come back and it's hung in my room. That's it. Room service. I just want to be able not to call somebody and I'm flipping through these pages and I just want to go pictures, click, 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 and somebody brings up the food, right? I don't want a robot bringing the food. I'd love to have a waiter dress up my room service table. And
do you like a turn down service as well?
Yeah, you know what? I do.
What is a turn down service? I've always wondered. I know what they do, but like, what's the concept about it?
It's the sense that you feel that you've got to a room where your lights are dinged, your curtains are closed, and it's lit, and your bed is ready to receive you. What it is. Now, imagine if you come back to your room, the lights are bright, the curtains are open, and you're running around, closing curtains, doing this and doing that, with someone that's taking time to actually prepare that for you. How beautiful is that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Culturally, do you reckon there's a country out there that does it better than anyone else when it comes to hospitality?
Look, I say in Asia, not a country in general, Asia. Any hotel you stay at across Asia, the service levels are unparalleled.
Japan
is on my bucket list. I've not been cut yet. Where I want to go at some point, hopefully this year. What I hear from, and recently, because I'm talking a lot more about Japan, I'm surprised you brought it up, but a lot of people who've been to Japan, they tell me how amazing the food, the culture, and the service. But across Asia, look, I've stayed in China, I've stayed in Korea, South Korea, and I've stayed in Bangkok, and been around Asia, and in India, the service levels are just amazing.
Flip side, where's the worst type of service levels?
Look,
I know it's a generalization.
It's generalized,
but it's okay.
The U.S. today, to me, is probably the worst part of the world to receive any kind of service, and you pay top dollar, right? You pay top dollar, you pay service charge. On top of your service charge, the waiter comes and tells you, this service charge doesn't go to me, I need a tip. You're paying other tips. Sometimes you're paying up to 30% on top of your bill. and food is not cheap, restaurants are not cheap. I was in Miami, and you get really biased down in Cirques. Staying in hotels and some of our houses, the lack of attention to detail, and our business is all about attention to detail, right? Imagine you go to a 3-star Michelin restaurant. You know, what is a 3-star Michelin restaurant? It's all about the attention to detail that they do. The plate comes in as a piece of art,
yeah,
right? And then you stay in a hotel where some of the basics are unmet, really basic stuff. Just the attitude of the employees. I stayed in a hotel I've made. It was 1 hour for the era.
Come on, you can name it.
In the U.S. New York.
We're getting close.
New York.
Manhattan?
I stayed in New York. In Manhattan.
Okay. Upside.
West. Where's it done? This is last year. Okay, not this year. This is last year. Last year. And I arrived at the hotel at Nuke. And she told me, check in is at 2:00. I said, all right, but I just blew in the card, in it. Is the hotel full? She said, check in, it is at 2:00. I said, okay. Is there a place I can get lunch? She said, yeah, there's a restaurant right there. A place I can leave my bag? Yeah, I can leave your bag here. So I was like, okay. So I went and had lunch. Came back at 1:45, 15 minutes before 2:00. And I saw people just hanging around. You could see people just hanging around the lobby, standing there, just down there. So everybody went past there, walked back to the lady, said, hey, can I check in? Sorry, sir, check in is at 2:00. I said, and she said, and by the way, there's 12 people ahead. I said, what does that mean? Do you have 12 rooms in this hotel? And what does it mean, 12? I mean, I booked a room and check-in is at 2:00, but are you punishing me? You wait until 2:00 sharp? She said, unfortunately, yes. I said, okay. So I went and stood at the side and she was calling me with
hey, Tom.
And but I purposely did this. Hey, Tom. This. Are you like calling me? She says, yeah. I said, my name is Haitham. And she says, okay, Haitham. Okay, you can check in now. 2:00 sharp. So she punished me. She made me wait till 2:00. Unreasonably, because on top of that, I went to a room and the floors were still wet because the weather was steady. It just mopped it with wet water and they left. The bathroom was wet. The AC was not working, so the room was humid. I walked in. I went back down. I said, please check me out. And I went to another hotel.
Wow.
That was my reaction.
That's awesome.
I went straight to another hotel. And I'll tell you what, Buddha. I went to a hotel. I walked in. And I paid $350 a night. And I loved it.
You must know the minute you walk in, within about 5-10 seconds, if you're going to enjoy this hotel. Absolutely. You just got this. It's just instant.
My biggest reason to walk out. So that's sort of the last straw that broke the camel's back, right? If she would have received me well, if she would have just let me in rather than punish me and make me wait until 2:00 sharp. But it was evident because all of a sudden, all these 12 people were checking in at 12 o'clock. So you can't tell me all rooms came out together.
Nope.
And the fact that I waited that long, and then I arrived to a room that was not necessarily ready. It did smell right. The floors were still wet. And I thought, wait a minute, I'm not staying here for free. I'm paying, even if it's a $100 tax, I'm not staying free. I'm one of these.
Right.
And I just decided I wasn't going to complain. I wasn't going to lose my temper. I wasn't going to say anything. I just said, Kree, please check me out. Right? She said, okay. At a house price.
She didn't put any resistance. No resistance.
Well, I checked out, went to another hotel.
Yeah.
And then I enjoyed it. I was going there for 3 days and I just wanted to.
You do this thing. I do this thing when I go to a hotel, in fact, anywhere. I'll look at the person who's behind the counter.
Yes.
And I'll just make a quick gut call on if I think they're going to be better at serving me than someone else. And it'll be instant.
The airline is the most important marketing weapon in tourism today. Airline is the lifeline of tourism. Without airline, you got people coming in. So yes, airline is the lifeline of tourism. Now, equally, accommodation is very, very important because you have airline. If people arrive and there's no place to stay.
Well, let's take a second on that. The reason why, so Dubai was built, right? Predominantly based on the success of Emirates. Ras Al Khaimah doesn't have an airline that I'm aware of. The association was Dubai Emirates, Etihad Abu Dhabi, Saudi.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Has that been the biggest challenge up until this point, that the fact that Saudi didn't have a flagship airline that could rival the likes of Qatar Airways, Emirates, and Etihad?
It has. And I think you see that they've recognized that and then recently announced, you know, Riyadh Air has an answer. They started to realize that they could probably not fix Saudi Arabia, Saudi Airlines, and hence they've created new airline, again, with new perceptions, new deliverables, new routes, new aircraft, rather than fix what they had.
The positioning, the perception of a country that you see through an airline is everything. British Airways, right? I go back when I was a kid, British Airways was British Airways. Now I look at British Airways and I'm like, it looks like the country, right? Absolutely. Apart from your love for London, generally speaking, it's not the best, right? I know it's a general comment, but can you make a statement that says as simple as good as the airline is, it will be as good as the destination it's going to take you to?
And how does it live? Me calling the airline being the lifeline of tourism into the destination is exactly what it is. It's the first impression, right? When you're traveling, you step foot onto that aircraft. And regardless of your hostess or where they're from, they represent the national airline of the country, right? So you start your assumptions and you build your perceptions based on how you're being served on the aircraft, what kind of food is being served. And that's where Emirates does it right all the time, right? You get authentic local foods. The menu talks about Emirati cuisine. You get consistent service no matter what sector you're on. You get the same colors, the same design, the same service with Emirates anywhere you go. I mean, this is going to be a plug-in for Emirates, but it's a great model of a brand for an airline. And where Emirates has come from in 1985 with three aircrafts that they leased from Pakistan Airlines, I think, at the time, to where they are today, becoming sort of the largest airline in the world, and the biggest container, not just in the region, but they've become the world's best airline. In everything that they do. And you're absolutely right. When you go, I travel to a city in Africa, Kuwait Airlines. I avoided going on their airline.
Nigerian Airways?
No.
Okay. Rwanda. They had their issues.
Okay. Rwanda Airways. Sorry, Rwanda. So, I avoided going. I could fly.
We don't have any listeners in Rwanda. At least I don't think so.
So I could have flown direct to buy Rwanda Air. But I avoided their airline. It was just my own subconscious perception. I'd never had experience before. But I preferred to go safe on Emirates, fly to Nairobi, spend 4 hours at the airfield, and take another flight to Rwanda on Kenyan Air rather than me going, a full flight all the way around the airline. So yes, it has a huge impact on your decision making when you're traveling, which airlines you take.
Hotels, will they ever look at airlines getting into doing joint ventures with them as part of hospitality, extending the hospitality chain?
So if look, Intercontinental was built by the founder of Pan Air, right? So the history of hotels is really so interlinked with airlines. And airlines have become much more advanced where hotels could learn so much from airlines. Like today, if you want to book a flight, right? You open now, you choose your seat. Right, you get your boarding pass. Now, why can't we do this in hotel? Why can't you go in and look at the building, choose the floor, choose the view, choose the whatever you want? And guess what? I want a bike in my room. Click, put bike in my room, right? Why can't I do that?
Yeah.
And then check in and I get a room key.
And the meals. Select the type of meals you want. I want gluten-free. I want this. I want that.
And it should be straightforward. If airlines have done it for hundreds and hundreds of passengers, and some airlines have just about the same amount of people you have in a hotel or more. Take 380, A380, right? 550 people. Some hotels don't even have 550 people. And we still don't get it right.
Good insight.
Yeah. So the highest virtue is to serve others. How does that stand in 2025?
So this was a quote by Cicero, okay? Famous philosopher. He said, the highest virtue is to serve others. How does that same statement stand up in 2025?
Nelson Mandela said a little bit, to lead is to be of service. And this morning I heard a quote that escapes me by Martin Luther King, and it was also about being of service to others. If you're working in the financial sector, you are of service to those investors. Doesn't matter. If the investor calls you and says, they sell, buy, you're of service. If you're working in technology, you're of service, Josh. You're building services for people to enjoy, take yourself, even gamification in hotels. So look, I think the world will never change in my mind, of people who are either naturally in their DNA, love to be of service. You're a great host. I came in and you say, let me get you a coffee. What do you want? That subconsciously, you're being of service to your guest. Because you told me earlier, you host people in this house, right? You host them for dinners. You host them for brunches. You're being of service to them. So when the guests come to your house, you don't say, hey, you want coffee? Go grab it. Yeah, you're doing the U.S., by the way. You're, you're not going to tell me to go grab my coffee. You're going to go and make it for me, because that gives you the sense of being the host. You're the host. I'm your guest.
Right.
Naturally, you are being of service. So it is not demeaning, by the way, to be of service of others. No, not at all. It actually makes you bigger.
I mean, this show is about me being of service to the guest. Absolutely. Ultimately, it's about getting the guest to feel as comfortable as possible, for them to feel and share insights that others can be inspired by. If the better you are as a host, the better the guest will feel. And that's what you do on a daily basis. The question I had in mind was, right now, serving others doesn't seem to be as virtuous as it once did, right? It seemed to be, if you go back decades, it was seen to be a very noble thing to do. Sure. Now, the world of, I want to serve myself, I want to take care of myself, I'm going to put my own oxygen mask on before I serve anyone. It's that kind of mentality, which I understand. But I feel like things have shifted to, it's more about me. It's more about self-healing, self-reflection, self-meditation, and all that stuff, rather than trying to worry about other people.
You're talking to the wrong guy, because I'm a giver by nature. And I'm a giver, not a taker. And I don't expect people who I give to give back.
You get a lot of bad people.
Yeah, they're not that different. So there was a people are not bad,
not rude, not arrogant, not like,
you know what? We're never born dead. Have you ever seen a bad baby?
So that's so William Blake, it was the world of innocence. So you're born with a clean slate. Yeah. Right? He was a famous poet, but it's the world of experience that corrupts you. It's the adulthood that corrupts you.
I think, look, it's the trauma you go through as a child. It's the experiences that you said. All that is the situations. It's
people like us. Yeah. Right, we're gonna end on a white clean golf ball. Right, there's no question on it. You get to ask anything you want to ask, or you get to say anything that you want to say that you haven't already.
Ah.
Power is yours.
First, I'm grateful to be on the show with you.
I'm super happy to have you on board again and see you.
Happy to reconnect.
Yeah, man. Yeah, for sure.
Great to reconnect with people. And it's probably one of the things I'd say is we talked about this, and for people who are, givers and genuine, I explain myself. I see myself as an authentic person. A lot of people see me as that. Now, people like me sometimes can get misunderstood. And it's because you're genuine and you're authentic and you're a giver. A, you get taken advantage of, but also you get misunderstood because you may not be communicating well. You might, I'm a person who always looks at the end goal in mind, and then that's all I see. Now, because I've been independent since the age of 17, been the form of my life, and I've always done it, as John Sinatra says, my way. And it doesn't mean that I exclude people, but I sometimes think in this very horrible world of ours, you don't necessarily want to involve your loved ones, and you don't want to put them through some of these experiences unnecessarily. So it's unfair. It's not fair. It's not right. But you sort of trying to protect it. And you carve your way up thinking about the end goal. And that could be professional, by the way, or personal. It could be at work. You're thinking about the end goal. You're not taking your team on the journey. And it could be in your personal life. You're not taking your loved ones with you on the journey. And they do not see the end goal with you. Even if you told them we're going there, they want to be part of the journey. Your team want to be part of it. So in leadership, whether you're leading at home, because you're home, you're leading at home. Yeah, it doesn't matter if you're male or female, you're leading. And you're a role model to your children, your loved ones, and even your girlfriend, your wife. They see you as a role model as well. And you're a role model at work. So if you're not taking the time to take people on the journey with you and explain to them the challenges you're going through and allow yourself to take help, that's one of my biggest challenges. And I'm sure a lot of leaders out there in the world do not ask for help. We're just a big meal marshal. We can do it ourselves. I don't want to trouble anybody with it. That's the perception. The reality is, I don't want to get people to go through that. mess, I'll just go through it myself. You know, it's like washing dishes. I don't want anybody to wash dishes. I'll just wash the dishes. So it's really important. It's a great learning for me to be honest with you, is it whether at work or at home or in my relationships, whatever, or even friends, the biggest learning is if you have an end goal, make sure everybody is going with you and make sure that they understand every single step of the journey. And if you got burns in that journey, they must be part of that. Because when you reach the end, and because they've been through the hurdles, it's much more meaningful for them as well.
Man, it's a beautiful insight. Really, it's a beautiful insight. Hi, Thomas. It's been great having you on the show.
It's been great to be on the show.
Thank you so much for coming on board. I think for me, someone like yourself is at the sort of, you're helping to try and drive an agenda within this region. And we all want to see this region be successful, right? Whether it's at the hospitality angle, whether it's the tourism angle, you're the one of the types of people that want to try and bring people into this great part of the world to sort of showcase what we have to offer. And if everyone has a little bit of hospitality that you have,
that hosted capability, man, this region is gonna go to new levels. Honestly, you're an amazing guy.
Thank you.
I love your down to earth level. I love the fact that you're a CEO, but you're also a guy that we can have a conversation with.
Casual thing.
So yeah, you are authentic.
Never for you where you came from.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. And what you said to me before, when you walked in, you feel like some people feel a little bit intimidated by you. Honestly, I didn't feel that.
Amazing.
I felt the guy who I've met before. I have a beer with, like a conversation with, and that's a vacation.
Thanks, my brother. I appreciate it.
So, guys, thank you for watching. Please like, subscribe, and share, and see you soon, very soon, actually, on Lucas Inside Track.